You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stu Goldsmith, and this is an absolute joy. This is a podcast I recorded in summer of last year with Jake Johansson, a fantastic American comic, someone who's performed in the comedy industry for over 3 decades and has had 45 appearances on Letterman, probably more. I was 45 when we spoke, I think, or maybe even 46, I'm not sure. But nonetheless, he knows his onions in a way that few people know their onions. We're going to talk about some of the decisions he's made in his career and the effect they've had. He's going to talk about why planning as a comedian is effectively pointless. And we're going to get really stuck into some very interesting ideas about writing and his craft and his technique and all of that stuff as well. If you are in the Insiders Club, you can also enjoy some extra material with Jake talking about how and why he turned down a major role on the sitcom Seinfeld and some other stuff besides. So go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to access that on the private podcast as usual. I'll chat to you a bit more in the middle of the show, but for now, this is the wonderful, very warm and very funny Jake Johansson. I sat on my method of public transport this morning watching some videos of yours that span an incredible period of time.
Oh, yeah, well,
you can watch your shoulder pads grow in, like, out and then in.
Some of that was my choice, but I feel like a lot of it was not my choice, shoulder pad-wise. I mean, that's just a thing that happens to you in the world. You don't realize it's happening. You don't feel like a fashion victim. You, person listening right now, you don't think you're a fashion victim. You don't think you're in the moment. You think you're making choices of your own free will, but you're not. You're choosing from the options available based on your personal preference.
Yes.
But sometimes the options are so extreme. Like there was a time in the 80s where the shoulder pad choices that you could make were, there were some ridiculous, like, spaceship kind of spacesuit options. Like, I'm the commander of this rocket, and I made that choice. But in a dressy sort of a way. Yeah. Yeah, and you don't feel old until you go on the internet and look at the things that you did.
In the 80s.
In the 80s.
You were a comic in the 80s, like back in the day, kind of what we think of, I suppose, as the birth, the first big boom of stand-up comedy. You're there with a, not a wacky tie, but a kind of, it's pretty loud.
To be, you know, fair to me, it was idiosyncratic at the time.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
But it wasn't wacky. I was wearing ties that were from... It was the 80s, and I was wearing ties from the 40s.
Yeah, okay,
and so
got it.
That was kind of fashionable, right? So where are we now? We're at the 2018. So if you go back, actually, you can go back to the 80s if you were wearing ties from the 80s. Like that piano tie, there's the tie, the necktie that was the keys of the piano. That is, we're probably about 5 years away from that being a thing again.
Sure.
That people wear and to remind them of that time. And pushing the sleeves of your sport coat up to the elbows.
Yeah.
I never did that. I never did that. But okay. I thought about it.
Yeah.
Like that was on the menu of things that you could do right before the show. Maybe I'll just push my
Maybe I'll just put these up a little bit.
Sleeves up. Like I'm going to wash the dishes in my suit. But I never did that. I always took my jacket off to wash the dishes.
When you are... I mean, do you look back at any of those things? Do you seek, because you can chart, and I should, for the sake of people listening who are maybe less familiar with you, you come to us as, is it 45 Letterman appearances?
46.
46. Yeah,
46. There's some. The internet can confuse you that way, but my count is 46.
And is that the
sure
record?
That's accurate.
Are you the most?
It's
guested?
The record for. Yeah, you know what is that asterisk? It's the record for the most appearances doing stand up. So gotcha. I went on and did stand up every time. Sometimes I sat down and talked to him as well, but you know, there's other people like. I'm pretty sure Jerry Seinfeld and obviously Richard Lewis have gone on and just talked to Dave and not done stand-up. And they've been on more times than me, and probably other guests like Tony Randall or whoever had been on more times. But, okay. But to go on and just do stand-up, it is I have the record for that. That's
and,
my...
And that is like, it's a bit like one of those ice core samples of your comedy. Do you know what I mean? Like you get this kind of...
Yes.
Like a cylinder yes. that you go, look at all the levels of... Not just the shoulder pads, the style, the references, material about phones and pages
yeah.
and material about, you know, turning into material about websites. It's like a sample of culture.
Well, the funny thing is, as a comic, you know, you're always trying to talk about things that are interesting to you at the time. And I feel like I personally have been early on a lot of things to talk about those things. But then when you go back and look at the ice core, you can't really tell... It's like, well, of course, everybody talked about Starbucks. But, you know, I think I did that early. I think I was one of the guys who talked about the Starbucks and the way you order and stand in line and the feelings you have in there.
Yes.
And then other people maybe saw it and said, oh, no, well, I could talk about that now, too.
Sure.
So, but, you know, that's the bragging thing. That's when you sound like you're bragging a little bit. But so I'll go back and look at all the, I won't go back and look at them all. It's not like I sit in my room and cry and look at my old sets. But sometimes you're going online to find something, to send someone a link to do something, and you sure. wind up going down the rabbit hole of your pasts. And I remember when I first started comedy, I started in 1982, and I remember being a big Woody Allen fan when I was a kid and trying to find Woody Allen's stand-up. Because I had seen, you know, those early movies, Sleeper and Bananas mm-hmm. and stuff, and then I was starting to do comedy and interested in what was his stand-up like, and listening to it and thinking, oh, back then in the 60s, you could go a long time before you had to get a laugh in your story. Like when you listen to some of his classic mm-hmm. bits, you know, it's really a long sort of story with some little kind of fairy interesting
some humor
asides
in it,
and then when he finally gets to the big punchline, the finale mm-hmm. of the story, you're like, oh, we really went on a long trip to get that. And now when I watch my own stand-up from the 80s, sometimes I feel the same. You know, the way audiences and comics are relating to each other, because I think it's a relationship. It's like in music, you're watching a guy play an instrument, but in comedy, you're watching a comedian play an audience. They're interacting. And so even when you're watching on TV, you think you're watching a comic do his show, but really you're watching the audience watch the comic. And you're trying to pretend that you're part of that audience, but you're not. It's that audience and that comic at that moment. And so when I go back and watch some of those old Lettermans, I feel like what I was doing was kind of state of the art. Sounds braggy, but it was of the moment. It was that's I was one of the cool guys doing what I was doing. That's why I was on Letterman at the time. But now when you go back and look at it, it's like, oh, isn't that cute?
Him
telling those kind of stories that way, and oh, that's the big punchline of that. Except it's me. It's not Woody Allen. It's not some other old guy.
Oh, and it's exactly the same experience.
It's actually me watching myself, thinking, "Oh, isn't that cute?" The way
we kind of went around the houses together.
Yeah.
So, what set you apart then at the time in that context of, let's say, kind of 80s? What when you say you were that the reason that you got on Letterman so often? Was it that you were, was it being that kind of vanguard of like, this is how we're going to do stand-up now by noticing things that are very much happening of the time? Was it that you're, because you have a very, like your persona was very distinct, you know, that kind of, your delivery was very distinct, that sort of staccato kind of hesitant turning the idea over as you speak.
I think that was organic to me. I mean, I was trying to be the way I am conversationally, trying to work things out and get the audience on board. And luckily, they thought that was kind of a funny way to be. But it was of a time where there were even way more extreme idiosyncratic examples of the way people were relating to audiences. Bobcat Goldthwait was, you know, he blew up kind of just before I came on the scene, and Emo Phillips was big at the time. And those are, you know, when you watch what they were doing with their voices and the way they were dressed and presenting themselves, I mean, it was almost like a cartoon caricature of a person. So yeah, I think I was in that family of that moment, and I think Dave kind of related to what I was doing. I was a generation or two, you know, after when he started. And so I think at the beginning it was like, oh, I like this guy. He seems, people like him and he seems cool and I support what he's doing. So then I think my relationship with him was always, with David Letterman, was always like, he felt as if he was helping a guy who had come after him that he liked to be successful, mm-hmm. you know, as you do, right? I mean, you, if you're ever doing a show, you're looking for somebody to come on and open or be in the show with you. You want to pick guys who, I just found this guy. He's really great. He doesn't have as much success as I've got, and he's going to come after me and be successful like that, you know? So I'm like the kid who never left home, you know, your 38-year-old son who lives in the basement. I just kept going on Letterman. And then now at this point in my career, that's my thing. That's what I've got the record for, is 46 Letterman appearances. I mean, I did have a few TV pilots and whatnot, but I didn't have that blow. I didn't have that Drew Carey moment, you know, where 1 minute he's on The Tonight Show and 6 months later he's got his own hit TV show. I didn't have that.
And do you think you could have had that? Do you think you could have manufactured that by kind of
I was in the Disneyland metaphor line. I was in the line with the ride with the ticket. I mean, I did several pilots where it was going to be my show about me and my situation, but they didn't. You know, the show has to be good. So sometimes the show was not good, and the politics at the network, the executives and everybody have to like the show and be in a position to push it across the goal line. And between those two things and probably a couple of other variables, you have to be a little bit lucky. All of the things never aligned at the same time. So I don't know. It's interesting now. I feel like I've still got a lot of career and good times left. This thing that I'm doing now, the reason that we're seeing each other in London, is great. I'm definitely at a point in my career where I can now say that that's what I did. I did that. And a lot of it doesn't feel like, obviously it is deliberate. It's all based on choices that I had and then things that were beyond my control that happened and then subsequent choices that I made. So everything that's happened to me has been, you know, I take responsibility for it, but it's quite different from what I thought. Because I thought I was on a track, and I thought, and my manager thought, and the dream was, oh, you're going to become like Seinfeld or Ray Romano or Drew Carey. But instead, I toured comedy clubs and did that, made friends, and I have the respect of my peers and all that. You know, I don't know if that sounds like I'm rationalizing, but it's been a great ride so far.
I don't know if I apologize to the listener if they've heard me say this on the show before, but I think I've been doing comedy for 13 years. Before mm-hmm. that, I was a street performer for about 10 years. So I've been making people laugh for a living for quite a long time, not as long as yourself. But I think as a comic that I reached a point where I was always looking forwards and going, what will I be? Who will I be? What will I do? And then I sort of had this weird epiphany where I went, actually, the comic I am and the relative success that I have I realized I could look back at the choices that I'd made and go, rather than going, who am I? I can just go, well, I've done enough of it now. And I can actually look back and go, oh, I'm this guy, because I decided to not do a particular gig because I wanted to go to my nephew's birthday. Right. Or I decided to, you know, I made decisions along the way. Like, I could have pushed harder for that, but it just seemed to me like everyone that was trying that, I didn't want to be like one of those people.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, that's what I do to anybody who wants advice, and now I've got a kid, I mean, I would say you are your choices. You create yourself every day by the choices that you make, whether it's simple things like, do I tell the truth or a white lie about this? Or the exact example you chose, do I take this gig or go to this family event and birthday? And all of those things may seem like nothing, but they define you. You're the kind of person who does this, and they take you to the place that you wind up. And I think in show business, probably other careers too, but I can only speak for the thing that I've done, you can wind up getting lost a little bit in what other people think that you're doing. You know, other people can look at your career and go, oh, that's too bad that you didn't get to be, you know, Drew Carey or Jerry Seinfeld or Ray Romano. But from my point of view, I don't know what it'd be like to be them, but I spent a lot of time learning how to surf and, you know, meeting my wife and taking vacations with her and spending a day going to the movies and riding my bike to the comic book store or whatever I was doing that those guys didn't get to do. I mean, I had a lot of slack, good times and fun, and the choices that guys who've had that kind of success, you know, you read that book, The Late Shift, about Jay Leno, when Jay Leno got The Tonight Show over Letterman.
I've heard of it, yeah.
The stuff that Jay did to get that show, I mean, he wanted it, and he paid the price. He did the hard work, and he stayed up late, and when it came time to going to the executives and proving to them that he wanted it, he did what it took. And I realize about myself, I don't think I could do that. You know, I don't think... I mean, the bottom line is I wouldn't want it that much. I'd rather feel like, look, if you don't want to give me this, I'm not gonna get on my knees or prove, or, you know, my perspective. I don't want to make it seem like I think he did something wrong. But I think sometimes the ambition and the drive that some of these really successful people have, that's their thing. And my ambition and drive is on a more personal level, to connect to just smaller individuals like you, like in your example of the family, to have my wife and daughter come on this trip with me and for us to have this time in London. Yeah, I'm on tour with Russell Peters, but at the same time, my wife and daughter and I went to see this London theater show last night. It was great. And my whole career has been based on that kind of choice of, like, I'm going to do this, and at the same time, I'm going to do that. You know, it's been good.
Your comic perspective, your persona as a comic, you mentioned before the almost like like Emo Phillips and Bobcat had that kind of, like they were kind of a comic book version of a, you know, or a cartoon version of a person. And I'm interested in, so I read a review of yours or some sort of quote about yours, which was that it was a bit like watching The Far Side. Remember The Far Side?
I do.
Comic strips?
And when that guy wrote that, The Far Side was on, it was a thing.
I remember how huge it was. It was everywhere, yeah.
Let's not forget the ice core sample of my career. And next to me in that ice core was Gary Larson doing that. But yeah, he said that, and I think I've had some weird observation stuff in my act, and I still do. That's some of my favorite things to put in. But as you do, you also want to kind of mix in some real. Well, I guess those are real things. The observation that you know, currently that machine, you know, artificial intelligence is going to take over, and what kind of kooky conspiracy paranoid yarn you can spin out of that. And then also, you know, my problems with my wife and daughter and us relating to each other as a family, all that goes in to the show at the same time. But I think I was a little bit more I think if you'd imagine that Bobcat Goldthwait and Emo, if you pretend, oh, the way that you see them on stage, that's the real person, they would be a hard person to spend an evening with. Whereas I would just be a slightly difficult, weird friend that you had,
yeah,
that you might like in small doses.
Okay, because I noticed when I was watching This Will Take About an Hour, which was, when was that, end of the 80s, 89?
Yeah, 92.
92, okay.
So I think 92, yeah.
And that, and there is some really heartwarming comments underneath it on the video. Someone's put the whole video up online. And,
yes, you can watch it on YouTube. Dirty pirates.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's even the quality, it looks like it's been... like the video has been shot of a TV in the 90s playing it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's the weird thing, isn't it? About that old, somehow it deteriorates, because I had recordings of it that have kind of degraded
over time
too. Okay. Either the VHS tape, it gets, twinkles of...
And also,
it's entropy, man. Yeah. You can't fight it.
Also, our idea of what quality means has changed now that we've got HD. Anyway, the point is there's some brilliant comments underneath it that people are like, oh, man, this changed my life when it came out. I loved it. Oh, thanks for uploading this. I've been trying to track this down, all the rest of it, you know.
You got to watch out with YouTube comments, though.
So. Yeah, I mean, don't read them.
Right next to that is, this asshole should quit and let...
But in that, there is a particular... In the first 10 or 15 minutes of it, there's... The thing about the phone guy. So yeah. I'm taking you right along. This is a long way back now. But something I loved about it was not just the kind of the slight off the wall, the thing about the phone guys are able to collapse their skeletons and, you know, climb in through your house.
To come up through the plumbing.
You know, that kind of stuff. I want to talk about the difference in your persona as time has gone on, because now your act seems to be more grounded, more kind of relevant to, not that you were less relevant, but it's kind of more accessible to a sort of an everyday experience. It seemed to me, looking at clips over the years, that initially there was a bit more of a kind of
I'm a weirdo. Yeah, I think so. You know, and someone had said to me that they missed the I'm a weirdo thing. And so I really tried to take a look at my set list and then, you know, highlight what out of the hour long set, you know, where is, I think it's always, there's always some I'm a weirdo and some this is what's happening to me that you might also, I mean, I am still a weirdo, but here's something that is happening to me that may also be happening to you. Aside from this other weird thing that I think that you don't think. And so I always feel like there's a percentage. Looking back then, I do understand what you're saying. And I think for a period, maybe in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a lot more I'm telling you about my regular experience and less I'm a weirdo. And since someone had said that to me, like they missed the I'm a weirdo thing, I was like, yeah, me too, kind of. When I went back and watched that some of that stuff. And even though I get what you mean by I'm a weirdo, I like that kind of paranoia and that the phone guy, how else can they get into your house if they can't collapse their skeletons? Like rats. That's the thing about rats, you know, they can get through if they can get their nose in, because they can collapse their skeletons. So that's why the phone guy... That's just a logical. To me, it wasn't such an I'm a weirdo thing. It was like I'm just going to mix these two ideas together to make it possible for not just magic to happen, but this real biological way that this guy could be getting into your house. And so, so I feel like I still have some I'm a weirdo stuff in my show. It's interesting because on this particular tour, where I'm doing all these gigs in support of Russell Peters, who is great, and it turns out we're mutual fans of each other. So I think he would be supportive of me going on before him and being more I'm a weirdo. From my point of view, is I want to go on and score and have a good show to set him up for what he's doing. You know, I'm a weirdo, but I'm also a professional weirdo. And so in that sense, the material that I picked for opening up these shows is heavier on the I'm married and this is my relationship with my wife and daughter. And also here's a little bit of I'm a weirdo, but then back to that.
Sure.
And so I feel like this, I hope this kind of answered your question. So I feel like there's a little continuum and the accordion sometimes is squished in all the way on I'm a weirdo. And sometimes it's expanded out.
Okay.
And I also have to go to the bank. You know, even weirdos have to go to the bank.
Yeah, sure.
So this is Jake. Such a pleasure to talk to him. You can find out all about Jake at his website, jakethis.com, and you can follow him on Twitter, at jakethis, and get involved and listen to his podcast as well. He's got lots and lots of material out there, and I don't know when he's next coming to the UK. As you heard, he was supporting Russell Peters on tour when I managed to track him down to speak to him. I think we met at the LA Podcast Festival, probably in 2015, which felt so futuristic at the time and now seems like it's 4 years ago. Well, there we are. More from Jake in just a moment. As I said, if you go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders, you can catch up with some extra material from this episode, including Jake on why he turned down a key role on the sitcom Seinfeld. And we're going to also talk about how to do well at a corporate gig. Jake's very, very experienced at corporate stand-up, and so, or you're surviving as a stand-up, thriving within the corporate marketplace. So we're going to get some top info on that as well, all available to members of the Insiders Club. Now, a couple of bits and bobs. I will talk to you in a post-amble. Thank you to everyone that came to Leicester to my crazy I-haven't-written-this-show-till-this-morning experiment. I'll talk to you about that in the post-amble. But thank you, everyone that came to the tour shows in Leicester and indeed in Maidenhead. Big shout-out to everyone there that was wearing their ConCom T-shirts in the audience. I always spot this. If there's enough light on you, I spot it. The Bees T-shirt, the Fuck 'em T-shirt, is harder for me to spot than the Polly Becker's brilliant horse design, which sort of glistens in the darkness. But my heart is very warmed to see both of those. Go to comedianscomedian.com/tour for the rest of my tour dates. The end of this week, I'm in Falmouth, and then I've got lots of other exciting places coming up amongst the Southwest and the Midlands, and then culminating in a quick run at the Soho Theatre. So if you would like to come and see me live, please do so. And next week, big announcement, I'm going to be releasing Like I Mean It, which is last year's tour show, and I'm going to do something experimental with it, as I like doing now that I'm in the very privileged position of having a small following amongst you and amongst people in the wider world. I get to experiment with, you know, just trying little things. Here's my idea for this one. You know, last year I gave away that tour show to the first 1,000 people that downloaded it on the podcast feed. Well, this one with Like I Mean It, I've had it pro-filmed by Turtle Canyon. Stuart Laws of Turtle Canyon directed it, and it's Canyon, right, isn't it? I've just seen those words, Turtle Canyon, in my head for the first time ever and gone, oh, that's right, isn't it? That sounds weird. It does sound weird, but it is that. Stu directed and shot James Acaster's repertoire, those 4 Netflix specials that dropped at the same time. And he's a very funny stand-up comedian himself, if you've ever seen Stu Laws at the MacFest or the Edinburgh Festival or anywhere else as well. Very, very funny person and fingers in many pies. Stu very kindly came along and shot and edited the show for me. It is all proper pro quality. And I'm going to be releasing 2 versions of it. The first is going to be made available on YouTube on the 28th of February for free. And hopefully in cahoots with another special organization, which I will get into as and when that comes out. The other part of it is going to be released again on the 28th, for purchase. And that is going to be a 90-minute-long director's cut, which is not a director's cut. It's a director's non-cut. It's a completely uncut. It's got all the fuck-ups in it. It's got all me tripping over my words, sweating profusely, redoing them. The sound went down for 10 minutes in the middle, and I kind of coped with it in a funny way. I tell the beekeeper's joke, and it's got me doing my own warm-up and being my own floor manager as well. It's really, really funny, and it really puts you right in the room. So if you would like to purchase that, you can do so for £5 at my website as of the 28th of February. So I will do a special micro episode of this podcast to remind everyone of that, but prepare yourselves for that. 11:30 on the 28th of February, that's this coming Friday. I am going, or possibly Thursday, is it 5, 6, 7, 8? It's Thursday. And that's going to be going off. I'm also going to be announcing the second leg of the tour, which is taking place in autumn this year. So if you want to come and see End Of and join in with the happy, laughing people in Maidenhead and Leicester, then please do so. That's all of that. Do check out Jake's stuff. He's such fun to talk to and a really, really funny man. Loads of stuff online from his numerous televisual endeavours. That's it for now. I'll post-amble at you at the end regarding my recent experiment, and I will speak to you. No, I don't need to say speak to you soon because it's the middle blurb, so just talk to you in a second. Here's Jake.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Well, this is it, because I'm wondering about your... We talked a little bit about kind of ambition or sort of relative ambition. Mm-hmm. I wonder... I feel like if I was looking at kind of 30 years plus of comedy... Then I would feel, certainly in my mere 13 years, I feel there have been years when I've thought, I've got to stay truer to this thing. And then there are years where I've thought, I've got to be more commercial. Do you know what I mean? I need to be more relatable. And I think I'm just interested in, obviously we can look back at it. We talk about looking back at it from the perspective of now. But I'm interested in whether along the journey or even in those early days or sort of 10 or 15 years in, you were thinking, in order for the next big thing to happen, I need to tailor what I'm doing.
I've often thought that if I could make that choice, I would be more successful. If I could say, look, I'm going to make the choice to do what makes me more popular, I'm going to be more successful. By successful, I mean what they think is successful, sure. Not what I think is successful.
Sure.
What, you know... From the outside, people judge your comedy career based on how famous you are and how much money you have, and then what, you know, accomplishments that signify that. You know, we're doing this show at Wembley. Now, so I'm doing a show at Wembley. It's Russell Peters' show, but I'm doing a show at Wembley.
Sure.
So, okay, from some point of view, he's successful because he's doing a show at Wembley, and I'm not successful because I'm opening for him doing a show at Wembley. But from my point of view, this is me doing a show at Wembley. You know, I did 3 nights at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles. I was opening up for Barry Manilow, but I did. My wife was like, I don't know if I like Barry Manilow. And I go, it's me. I'm doing a show at the Greek Theater. You need to come and see me. You can watch Barry if you want. It's a great show, by the way. These are the things that I'm doing. So I had often thought, what would my career be like if I'd made that choice to try and be more mainstream and be more popular? And I just realized that's not a choice that I could make. I said it to my manager, who's been my manager now friend for 20 years. And she said, you know, you give yourself a break. You couldn't have done that. If you had tried to do that, you would have fucked it up because you would have hated yourself and you would hate it. You would have hated the show and you would have either gotten yourself fired or you would have quit. And she's probably right. I mean, not that I'm some kind of highfalutin artist and I have nothing against selling out. I would love to sell out if the price is right. I'm looking for opportunities to sell out, but there's just some things that you enjoy doing and some things that you don't enjoy doing. And if I was giving career advice to anyone, I would say, look, go where they love you and go where you love to go and focus on what you think is funny. Try and be true to your sense of humor, and everything comes, all of your success comes from your ability to connect to that live audience. The reason someone wants to give you your own TV show or put you in a movie is they come and see you on stage in front of an audience, whether it's 10 people or 10,000 people. They see you in front of that audience and they see that audience's reaction to what you're doing. And so you're you should always be focusing on being true to yourself and communicating that to the audience. That's to me, that's the choice that I'm trying to make. That's the clarity that I have anyway.
Just on a tangential note, what's it like having a manager for 20 years? With that kind of that's one of those things that seems to me like I have been with my manager for 3 or 4 years, and I hope I'm with her for 20. But I just, that's one of those things that I kind of can't get my head around what the development of that relationship must be like.
Well, it's wonderful and terrible. You know, it's wonderful because I feel like she is there for me. She believes in me and she supports me and she tries to make, you know, the cliche, make my dreams come true. You know, what if I say, look, this is what I want to do next. She tries to figure out, like, is there a way? I want to make a comedy special. Okay, what's a way that we can accomplish that? And that, to me, in my world of how I make my choices, is more important than the way that when I jokingly say it's wonderful and terrible. That's the wonderful part. The terrible part is, you know what? There's many more managers out in the world who've got higher profile clients who, if they saw me connect to an audience and on a whim said, I want to be your manager, they might be able to take me in and stick me into some thing that one of their other clients was doing, you know, and all at once now I'm in a movie with that guy.
Sure.
You know, and I have this other bigger success. But they might think that that's what they're going to do, take you on board and then get bored with you, and then you just sit on their shelf and be like, I also have that guy. Or they may stick you in that thing and it turns out that that's the one thing that that other client did that wasn't popular, and now you it didn't happen and you're just stuck with this manager who thought, you know, they lit the fuse and the firecracker didn't pop, and now you're just with someone who they don't believe in you, they don't care about your dream, they don't want the next thing to come true. So it's a bit of a, I mean, that's the trade-off. Some people think, oh, you should never become friends with your manager. You should, you know, they're there to serve you. And if they're not blowing you up or making you bigger or getting the things that you want, screw them and get rid of them. And I'm much more from I need someone who believes in me, because sometimes I don't believe in myself. And I need someone who's going to be out there working hard, making phone calls to try and get me what I need to survive, which is, you know, live performance dates. And some managers, they're like, well, if you're not a movie star, call me, you know, or don't call me, because I'm not going to focus on helping you make a living or helping you stay creatively satisfied. My focus is on just making you your big star bigger, you know.
When you say you, and I realize you just say this in passing, but in the something we talk about a lot on the show is the realms of self-belief. When you say, like, because I don't believe in myself, sometimes, how can you chart your self-belief over your career? Have there been times of greater or lesser self-belief, or is it a kind of day-to-day, week-to-week?
Yeah, I think it's more of an accordion kind of, sometimes it's squished up and sometimes it's blown out.
And I don't think you're different from a lot of comics in that respect.
Oh, I don't think I'm different from a lot of human beings. I mean, everybody has those days where you're just like, God, I thought I really had this thing figured out. And now today I feel like I don't know what I'm doing. You know, that's stand-up, right? The longer you've been doing it, the less kind of horrific. Well, I don't really have terrible bomb sets anymore. I mean, right, you know what your greatest hits are and you can always sort of revert to that. But you know, you have those times where, oh geez, I really was sure that that joke was going to work, or that I could start my set off this way in this situation, and it didn't work. And I'm not positive why it didn't work. You know, those kind of lost moments where you kind of have to just reset and I'll figure it out. But I think everybody has that. I mean, that's one of the, when you said you were a street performer for years, there's a guy in the States called Michael Collier who started off on the streets and has become really successful. And he used to perform in Venice Beach, which is near where I live. And so I'll go down there sometimes. And not many guys doing just straight, he was doing stand-up comedy, like just talking, not juggling or any other tricks. Yeah, there's very few. And to be able to grab a crowd, hold a crowd, and then get them to put some money in a hat after, it's like, oh my God, that's the prize fighting of comedy right there.
Yeah, prize fighting. It's about as healthy as prize fighting.
Yeah.
I'm interested, when you have those moments of thinking, oh, that didn't get the reaction I thought it was going to get. Let's talk about some of the tougher moments, either on stage or pre-stage or afterwards.
Everybody always wants to know, like, oh, what's it like when you're bombing? And what about when people heckle you? And
I want to know what's it like. What are you like when you recover? I want the positive version of that. The internal monologue that gets you back either in the moment on stage or in the vehicle on the way home.
Do you remember the movie Officer and a Gentleman?
I have not seen that movie. I'm aware it exists.
Yeah, it's a long time ago, right? But Louis Gossett Jr. is a drill sergeant, and God, who is it? It's Tom Cruise,
is it,
right?
Richard Gere?
Richard Gere. Is it Richard Gere? Tom? Anyway.
One of them.
The handsome guy is trying to become a Navy fighter pilot. I'm pretty sure it's Tom Cruise, but we could pause, but who has got time?
You really? You keep talking. No, I'll keep forget it.
Okay, yeah. And Louis Gossett Jr., it's raining, and he's making him do push-ups or sit-ups or something. And he wants him to quit. You want to quit? Why don't you quit? And the guy who's trying to be a pilot is doing push-ups in the rain and just is so angry and depressed. But he's just like, this is all I've got. And he's crying. And I remember at the time, so that movie was when? In the 80s, late 80s, 90s maybe? And at the time I started in San Francisco. I went there because that's where Robin Williams started. And Robin Williams would still come back, and you know, that was the thing. If you were around San Francisco, he would be there, and you could meet him and talk to him and then see him go on stage and improvise with other stand-ups in little tiny 150 seat clubs. And he was on stage doing an improv one time, and it was another comic, and the premise was they weren't trying to get into the Air Force. They were comedians and they were trying to do comedy, and the other guy was trying to get him to quit doing comedy. And Robin Williams was doing the sit-ups and crying and screaming, like, I can't quit doing it. This is all I've got. And it just made me think of that when you were asking that question. So I kind of feel like at this point, the amount of real job opportunities that I have is zero. I mean, there's not a job that I can get, unless it's the kind of job that you get when you've just kind of come out of some kind of blackout alcoholic drinking life of 30 years, you know, you're just like, I just got to wash dishes and stay at the halfway house. I could get that kind of job. So there is a little bit of I have to find a way to get back. And, but the disappointments that you suffer now, all right. You know, I mean, all depression kind of feels permanent and severe. But if you just kind of relax, you have a good cry, you know, get a good sleep, you wake up the next day, you're all right. Then you start getting excited about the next set you're going to do. And like, famous last words, but if you're a comedian, you know that, like, oh, I'm pretty sure I knew where I blew it. I know what I'm going to do the next time. This time, instead of I'm going to fake this way and then go that way, you know, you're just positive that you've got it figured out, or at least you're positive that you've got an idea that you want to try the next time that you think it might work. That's a thing that I say to comics a lot of times when they're telling me, so I've been doing this joke, not that I'm some kind of joke doctor, but I've been doing this joke and I can't get it to work, or I'll see them say something, and I'll say that it's really funny, and they go, "Yeah, I like it too, but it doesn't." You know, as a comic, you're always liking the joke that's weird. I am.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And they'll be like, "Yeah, I like that joke too, but I can't get it to work." And the thing I always say is, the reason a joke doesn't work a lot of times is not because the audience doesn't get it because it's a bad joke. The joke doesn't work because you know something that they don't know. There's some part of the setup that you're taking for granted that they're not aware of. So, yes. So it's not the punchline that's the problem. It's not the joke that they don't get. It's that they don't have enough of the setup to realize that that's all jokes are tricks. They're like unexpected. Like, I didn't think he was going to say that. And so something has to happen in the setup to help them realize what you think the joke is. Like, what do you want them to think you were going to say? And then you're going to say the other thing. Not to oversimplify or take the magic away from all the people who are listening to this thinking
no one's listening to this. No one's listening to this thinking there's any magic left.
Yeah, so I think if you're struggling, if you're a comic and you're trying to write a joke and it's not going over, but you think the idea is really funny or clever, the problem usually in my experience is not that you need to quit the joke, it's not going to work, this is a bad idea. The problem is you know something that the audience doesn't know, and you need to figure out what that is and then how to put it in there without making it obvious. I mean, some people's favorite jokes in the or I think from doing stand up all these years, the jokes that people really like the most are the jokes where you said the punchline a half a second before they thought of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's what you're trying to give them all the ingredients to write the jokes, but then you go, ha, I got there first.
That's interesting. I love those jokes where I've one or two of these in my set at the moment where the audience, like, you give them all the components and the clever kids get it. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a laugh and then there's another laugh where there's like the other one. You know, catches up. I think that the flexibility of when we're all on the same page, it constantly fascinates me.
Well, or, you know, it's like laying down cards of a good poker hand. And some people.
Oh, that's a nice analogy. Yeah.
You know, so some people can realize, oh, that's going to be a full house. And other people don't quite get it. So you put the next card down. And I had a joke in my act way back in the Ice Core sample about moving to California and having this leather jacket and how it was weird to be in California because, you know, this vegetarians and so I'm walking down the street, my suede jacket, and this woman comes up to me and says, excuse me, sir, did you know that a cow was murdered for that jacket? And I would look at her and say, you know, I didn't know there were any witnesses. Now I'm going to have to kill you too. And I could always tell how many smart ones there were in the crowd. Sometimes people would laugh when I said, I didn't know there were any witnesses.
Yeah.
Sometimes everybody would laugh.
Sure.
Sometimes nobody would laugh. But then when I would say, now I'm going to have to kill you too, then the penny drops and they get it. And so that's an example of what I'm talking about the ingredients in the joke. It's like, the joke is, I'm the guy who killed the cow.
Yes.
But you don't get it until you get it.
Yeah, and when you get it, like, because there's such an element of danger and kind of, like, not only did you kill the cow, you'll kill anyone to get away.
Yeah, now I'm killing you. Like, you're a witness. You're going to dob me in for killing this cow, and I've got to keep that from happening. I don't want to go to jail, as if you're going to go to jail for killing a cow.
So much ludicrous detail is contained. Like, you turn the Jeopardy up, like, just immediately all the way.
Yeah, there. Right. So you're flipping the card over. So just because you don't get a laugh on, now I'm going to kill you too, doesn't mean the joke's a failure. You need to play that other card and see if they go for that. And then sometimes if they don't go for that, then try another more, you know, just keep. I mean, it doesn't always work, but I find that if they don't get the joke at first, sometimes you just keep explaining it. They can finally, like, oh, I get the kind of crazy world you're living in where that's what you thought was going on. You know, who knows? That's me.
Do you have favorite kind of techniques or things you spot yourself doing? For a while, I like a few of my shows end with a kind of an unreliable narrator reveal. Like, I've given them some information that then at the end turns out not only is that false, but that now casts a different light on a lot of things.
All the other things.
Yeah, like, I really like stuff. Like, I'm internally congratulating myself.
I can't wait to try that unreliable narrator thing, Stu.
But is there an equivalent? Do you think of a thing that kind of makes you smile internally, a particular kind of mechanism of your joke telling?
I probably should. You know, that's the thing people always want you to do if you're pitching yourself for Jake Johansson should have his own TV show. Well, what based on his comedy? Well, what is comedy like? And I could never come up with that answer of like, this is what I'm doing. This is what my comedy is like. And so I seldom have thought about my comedy in terms of like, what's the template for this joke and what's the template for that joke? And maybe I should have more. I feel like that's another one of those things of like, you might be more successful if you can get the elevator pitch down of your act. Like, what do you do? Like, oh, you got to go see Stu because why? What's funny about him? Oh, but this is what he does. You know, boom, 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 sure. Little elevator pitch. That, it's good to have that. I've never had that, but I think maybe one of my in the I'm a weirdo category, I would say it's paranoia, conspiracy theory paranoia stuff that I find the most – it's funny. I like to go down that rabbit hole just as a joke. I mean, I think it's exciting to think that aliens live and work among us and that there's some secret organization of, Illuminati lizard people that are controlling the world. I don't really necessarily believe that that's happening, but it could be happening. And so I want to kind of spin out on that. Like, always take it back to that. It's that, like, how do we know that the robots aren't behind this? How do we know that the artificial intelligence isn't already in charge? How do we know that this isn't the Matrix? We're recording this inside of a recording of a thing of this.
There's a I can never remember the logical steps, but I'm sure you've read there's online somewhere. There's someone explains why, in all probability, we are living in the Matrix. And this it's a thought experiment whereby you go, well, because that, then it would be insane for us not to be living in the Matrix.
The simulation theory all the way down. No, I do get that. And I love the idea of that we're inside of an envelope that's inside of an envelope that's inside of an, how many envelopes? Is this my dream or is this your dream?
Sure.
You know, and I think we all hope the answer is it's my dream. Not my dream, but your personal, whoever the eye is inside of you, you think that the world is all, this is your dream.
Imagine what a humble person you would be if you're like, well, I really hope it's Jake's dream. I'm a peripheral character.
Oh, well, I'm fucking really having one over on you, Stu, because my life is so great. I don't think in fact, it's so great. I don't even think you're aware of most of the shit that I've done in your dream. If this is your dream, I'm loving it.
The point, I think what I was getting at before with regard to like a favorite thing is not necessarily, that's a really good answer, but I don't think I meant so much a sort of a subject area as a sort of stylistic thing. Like I noticed one of the things, the example is from a long time ago, it's from This Will Take About an Hour. When you're talking about the types of problem with the phone, it's misunderstanding to a very high extent. Some information. You're really good, I think, throughout your stuff. You're really good at misunderstanding things in a surprising way. When the lady's saying to you, and I realized this is years ago, from your perspective, the lady's saying to you, "What kind of problem is it with the phone?
What kind of problem are you having with your phone?" And I say, "Yeah, well, it's I pick it up and no sound comes out." Yeah, it still has mass.
It still has mass. It still has the ability to retain color.
What's wrong with your phone? It's weightless. Yeah. My phone is weightless, and it's hard to describe. It's not fuzzy visually. I can see it, but when I go to touch it, my fingers sink into it. They seem to sink into it. Like it looks like my fingers are going inside of the phone before they touch something solid. It's just. I don't know if is anyone else had this problem with the phone. Yeah, I didn't think of that as a misunderstanding thing, but I guess you are. I thought it was surreal sarcasm.
Yeah, absolutely. And later in the routine, she's talking about like, we'll send a guy out. And the response is, your response is, well, they'd have to send a guy out. I mean, I don't think there's a guy stationed at my house like that, you know.
Yeah, that's
surreal
again,
sarcasm,
that's,
exactly. Yeah. Okay, I've got to it. That's exactly
as
what
I'm
talking about.
Somebody's going
to
come out of the closet and like, hey, I'm here. Mm-hmm. Like, have you been there the whole time?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, well, that's answered my question, I think. I'm just really interested. I think that's a really good way to look at how someone perceives their own stuff is like what, like the pleasure that you get as a creative person.
Yeah, well,
creating
a particular
type of thing.
I am going to write down. Do you have a pen?
Yeah.
I need to write down surreal sarcasm. There's no way I'm going to listen to this. It's funny because you don't spend that much time. I don't spend that much time thinking about, now, what is it that I'm doing? You know, what's behind? I always think it's interesting when you go to museums, which I do like to go to art museums and see art. We're artists, right? We're artists. What we're doing. People don't, I mean, where do we get the balls to call it art? But we're making up creative things and people are coming and enjoying them.
I think
them,
the right? very first thing you said, we're artists, right? Yeah, that's what we are. We're artists, comma, right? Question right? mark? That's what we are.
Well, that's comedy always falls into that category. But it's funny, you know, in San Francisco, they would do the theater, the giant 2,000-seat theater, like all these great theaters in London, would have a benefit every year to benefit the actual theater, where they would get comedians to donate their time and put on a show. And it was one of the most popular things that the theater subscribers attended out of the year, was this stand-up comedy show. And you're on stage in there saying, look, you jerks, you think that we're just the dirty scum slum artists, but you love it. You love it. Now, why do I have to come and do a benefit for this 2,000-seat theater? There's a 200-seat comedy club that we're struggling to keep full for, you know, for our six shows during the week. You people love it. Why don't you go over there and see that show? And it's because they somehow have separated it from being art.
Yes, it's only allowed to be art if it's a gala fundraising dinner. Then they can lower themselves to come and see a thing they actually want to see.
Yeah, so one of the things I like to do is to go to an art museum, and it's nice to read the plaques and things on the wall where they're describing the art and what the artist was doing. But the older I get, the more I read some of that, and then I have to check out. And it's just like, look, this is just some dumbass who's got a college degree. They're no smarter than me. And it's what they think that Picasso was doing. Picasso didn't tell them this shit about his
paintings. Yeah, at no point. He didn't tell anyone.
Picasso was just walking around like, I'm going to get a glass of wine and fuck a lady, and then I'm going to buy a plastic monkey and I'm going to glue it to this truck. That's what Picasso was thinking. He wasn't thinking about, I'm making a commentary about men and machines. I mean, maybe he was. Obviously, that was part of his subtext. And so part of my subtext when I'm writing these jokes is I like this sci-fi paranoid conspiracy theory. I think that surreal sarcasm is funny. But I'm not like, okay, I want to tell a story about taking the tube to go see my friend, and I'm going to work I'm going to work those elements in. You know, you're not as aware of what you're doing as all of that. You're just trying to, you're doing what you're doing. You're telling your story. You're making your art with the tools that you've got available and the brushes that you like, you know.
And what does that actual work look like for you now? Is it always on stage? Are you sitting down and writing or typing?
This is the problem. And any comedian who has ever had a relationship with another person knows that it doesn't look like you're working a lot of times when you're working. It looks like you're just sitting there. Or it looks like you're watching cartoons. You know, or it looks like you're riding your bike to the comedy store. Or it looks like you're hanging out with your friends, drinking a beer or having coffee and just laughing. That's what it looks like. I feel like, you know, you're trying to stir your brain pot as much as you can. And then when something bubbles up, you know, when you say surreal sarcasm, you got to write it down. You got to catch it. It's a butterfly. It's going to fly away. You may never see it again. And so I think that for my creative process is I'm trying to be more disciplined, but you always think these butterflies are mine. You know, I said this funny thing. I'm going to remember it. That was funny. I'm a guy. I'll remember it. I'll come later tonight when I get home. I'll look at all the butterflies that are in this cage that I have, and I'll remember that one that I thought of today, and it'll be fine. But you can't do it that way. You got to write it down on a little piece of paper, stuff it in your pocket, and then like some crazy schizophrenic nut job, you got to do a detective thing on your own life. You got to take out the pieces of paper, and you find things that are written down, like this will be fun. We can go into my phone.
Great, great. I love doing this.
Yeah. So you write down little things, and then you lay, and you think that you've written down enough that you're going to be able to, that you're going to be able to, I'm just trying here. This would be the, this is a good one. So you write things down, and then you, so here what I've written down, simulation matrix, which is what we were talking about earlier. I was able to get you to bring it up. mirror neurons, which that kind of, so you just parasite host, which is preferable?
Parasite, go on, talk to me about more about what that idea is. Parasite.
Well, I did talk about this a bit on my pod. You can listen to my podcast. It's the Jake This podcast, Jake This of Jake Johansson. And some of them are me talking to other people. And I've decided that I don't really care if it's a show that people want to, you know, I don't, it doesn't have a clear concept, but it's a lot of me. And some of them are just me talking. So I did talk about this. You know, parasite or host, when I first say that, of course, you think you want to, you're the host, right? These fucking parasites are on you all the time. So you want to be the host. You immediately associate yourself, at least I think you do. I think one does. When I say the parasite or the host, we all think of ourselves as we're the host, right? We're the big organism that that. And it's great to be there, but is it great to be the host? Fucking parasites. They're just sucking off you and living off you. Wouldn't it be great to be a parasite? Someone else is doing all the work and you're just sucking it up and enjoying life. I think, you know, parasite, if you're a benevolent parasite, you know, if you have some symbiotic relationship, maybe it's nicer to be the parasite than the host. I mean, the host, it seems like the host winds up dead eventually. The parasites just suck you dry. But if you're the parasite, you know, you get to move on to another host. Fucking host, they're a dime a dozen. Am I right, ladies? I didn't mean that for me. That was a comedy. That's a thing that comedians say to the audience. I didn't mean that all ladies are parasites. Fuck, you got to be so careful nowadays.
So what will you take that idea onto the stage and talk about it in like a new material?
Well, just based on this conversation right now, I don't think it's ready.
as you were telling me that, I felt I wanted to write down on a board and hold up. I'm listening. I'm in listening mode as an interviewer now. Yeah. I'm not riffing. I'm sorry.
Fuck, Stu's not into it. He's not buying it. I think I will talk about it at some point. It's hard for me because the more I can work it out before I go on stage, the more productive the going on stage part of it is. Yes. But I often kind of feel like I need a little bit of audience feedback early on to kind of spur me to go back to the notebook to flesh it out a little bit and then come out again. But it's always that back and forth. There's only so much you can do. I mean, if you're a musician, you can practice your instrument in your closet at home. But if you're a comedian, you could make as many plans as you want, but until you actually say that stuff to an audience, you don't really, I mean, you have a better idea based on the amount of experience you have going on stage, whether or not it's going to work, but you really don't know how it's going to go until you start telling it to the crowd.
I find with a new bit, if I've got a new kind of concept, I need to know that the end has got a funny idea in it, which may or may not be funny, but I definitely know what the end is. And then I need a little bit of a funny thing in the introduction to, and so I'm like, it's almost like I'm saying to the audience, you're on board with this now, right, guys? That was a bit funny. Now I'm going to try and improvise my way around a bit, buoyed up with the confidence of knowing it goes somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did that work?
You know? Okay, yeah. So that's, I'm the same. I like to have a bit more than that. I like it to be the ideas that I'm going to tell a little story that involves that. As whatever that note that I've just taken, I'm going to tell a little story that involves that note. I know how the story starts and I know what I think the laugh is at the end. And then I like to have two other ones in the middle. So four altogether. And then I start talking at the beginning and I know that I'm heading towards the end and I try and take my time and fuck around as much as possible. And then when I feel like the audience has had it and they're going to bail, I do the first thing that I'm pretty sure is going to be a joke, and hopefully it is. And if it is, then I can fuck around a little while before I do the next one. And if the first thing that I do is not as It's going to get some reaction, but maybe it doesn't. But if it doesn't get a good enough reaction, I go right to the second one. And if that works, then I can screw around a little bit. And if that doesn't work, then I kind of wrap it up and get to the end and then go back to the drawing board. But so I've got a couple of beats, and then I'm trying to just flesh out in between them. And that's how I, you know, if we're talking about to go to process, which I think is a thing that you like to do, right? In my process, I was trying to do the new stuff first. If I'm doing an hour long show, and American stand up is a little different, I think, than over here where you're presenting your show like a festival show, where this is my new hour for this year. Mm-hmm. In America, the way that I've been considered fairly prolific, but I would say that I'd turn over, you know, 25% to 50% of the hour a year, and just gradual, like things get replaced, like the cells of your body get replaced.
It's a much smarter way of doing it.
Yeah. Well, it's smarter, but it depends on the fact that there's always enough people in the audience that didn't see you the last time.
Sure.
Whereas if everybody in the audience saw you the last time, you can't do that. So my approach then is to put the new stuff at the beginning. Come out, say hello. Maybe I've got one little thing that I know is a little bit of a laugh at the beginning, but enough people are there that know who I am. And then I can do the new stuff at the beginning. And so even if the response is lower, then sometimes you just do one new bit at the beginning. So you're on for 5 minutes and doing this thing and fleshing it out. It's kind of funny. And then you dive into your material that you know works. And maybe there's some new stuff sprinkled into there. But it's easier to do the new stuff at the beginning, and people are getting to know you, and then it feels to them like, oh, he started off kind of slow, and then it was like a freight train. He got built up momentum, and he got going, as opposed to you're in the middle of the show, everything's going great, and then you just...
Let me look at my notes.
When they don't see you do that. Hopefully you're not doing that.
Sure.
But you're like, now I'm going to take it. Now we're going off-road. We're going four-wheeling now in the middle of the show. And sometimes that's hard because the pacing of the laughs changes so much that you're not really giving that material a chance. You're putting it in a context where the audience is naturally going to think, well, this is not as good as the other stuff. And of course, the reason is it's not as developed as the other mm-hmm. stuff. Whereas if you put it at the beginning, it's still the reason is it's not as developed as the other stuff. But their perception in the audience is he's just getting started.
Yes, sure. And has the learning plateaued ever for you? Has, like, the rate of learning? Do you still learn as much now as in... Like, I feel like I learned a lot in the first few years, and then I probably kind of just kept going for a bit, and then I really started to think about something. Do you know what I mean? Like, that kind of graph over time of how much additional skill you're acquiring.
I feel like it's not a steady ramp. It's a plateau and a go-up, and then sometimes, you know... I've gone through a couple of periods in my life. There was I think at the end of that, this will take about an hour. I had a heartbreak, and then the end of the show is about this having my heart broken thing. And that kind of derailed a little bit of my progress on stage. For a while, it was just like, look, I'm so dealing with this personal thing that when I was on stage, I was really just doing the show that I had and slowly adding to it. So I've had those periods in my life, but I feel like now is a good creative time. Yeah, I mean, you're always trying to figure out some new thing to do. I feel like one great thing that happened to me was in the probably 17 years ago or 17 years ago, maybe 18. I did the Kilkenny Comedy Festival for the first time. And I had other experiences internationally, but just in Canada at the Just for Laughs, or I came over here and did one or two little shows in London where it was just to come over, do a TV show and fly back. Mm-hmm. But I did that Kilkenny Just for Laughs festival, and I made friends with a lot of international comics. That was the most fun thing to me about doing it, was getting to see these other comics and what they do that you've never seen, really good comics that you never saw before because they're someplace else, and the different ways that they do their acts and how it all works. And I got to come back a couple years later and made friends. And then I came back just 3 years ago to do this reunion at the Kilkenny Festival and got to see everybody else now after they'd gone on with their careers. You know, people like Ed Byrne and Dara O'Brien and Adam Hills. And then this last time I was having a beer with Adam Hills in Kilkenny. And, you know, and to me, he's just a guy I met at the comedy festival. I didn't really realize how huge and successful he is, you know. Because that wasn't, I mean, he's just a great comedian and a really nice guy. And we're talking about how, you know, in my career, I really love doing stand-up and, you know, all that other TV show stuff is great. But then you see a guy like Jerry Seinfeld, who's had that success, who's still going on stage doing live stand-up. And I had always kind of pitched it as if this is what I like doing. But then when you see a guy like, it really validates, this is the fun thing. I'm doing the fun thing. He did another thing, but I'm doing the fun thing. And now the evidence is he's going back to doing the thing that I've been doing all this
time. Yeah. That's very satisfying.
Yeah. And so I was having that conversation with Adam. And then I'd really kind of talked to Rich Hall and busted my ass to figure out a way to come to London. And my manager, who loves me and cares about me, got me a gig at the Soho Theater a couple years ago. And I came over and did that. And I did some other gigs on the side. And I ran into Adam because I said, hey, I'm coming to London. I'd love to see you over there. I've only seen him in Kilkenny. And he came out. We had some. He said, you know, you talk about doing comedy. I might be able to help you do this Melbourne Comedy Festival thing. And I said, well, that'd be great. And he says, yeah, I think I can produce the show. And I said, well, really, that'd be awfully nice of you. And in America, produce doesn't mean the same. You know, produce can mean,
sure,
I'm going to make a phone call and then you can pay the money and do it.
Yeah.
But he took the risk and got me down to Melbourne. I did the comedy festival in 2016, and I would be back there this year, but I'm doing this Russell Peters tour. And so I feel like where I'm at now that I'm really loving is this coming outside the United States at the tender age of how old I am, which you can look up on the internet. Do I have to do everything? I'm now trying to do these international gigs, and it's humbling in a sense. I mean, it's way easier for me to go and tour the States, and I walk on stage and people know who I am, and I can do my Is He Crazy or Not, and it's super fun and it's rewarding, and I feel like it's creatively satisfying, and in some ways it's more satisfying than struggling in Melbourne. Not really struggling, but you're doing a show for people who've never heard of you before, and you've got to really kind of figure out how to reach them. And it was such a positive experience to do the shows and to have the kind of varied audience response in the show, and then afterwards to feel how many people want to come up and say, oh, thanks for coming, we really enjoyed that. You know, they like the show, but they're not always laughing. You're warming up for yourself in those things.
Sure.
So to me, the idea that I'm growing, doing the same thing that I'm always doing and having new experiences doing the same thing that I've always done is really exciting at this point in my career. I mean, so that's what I'm loving right now, is trying to really figure out how do you go on and re-communicate who you are to people who don't know who you are, who haven't seen that whole ice core of your career. And you've got to sum all of that up and be true to yourself and not be too much of a weirdo that they're just like, fuck, I don't even know what's going on right now. But still do it again, to reinvent yourself. Right. First, it was at the Melbourne Comedy Festival and in Kilkenny at these comedy festivals. But now it's opening up for Russell Peters on these international shows where we're going to go to Oslo and Croatia and, you know, Amsterdam. And we've already been to Jakarta and Singapore. And it's really fun for me. And so I do feel excited and like there's a growth thing going on. And I think if you're a comic and you're starting to feel frustrated with what's going on, or if you feel like anytime you feel like, oh, fuck these people, and you got to go on stage and do the slap, like Bill Hicks said, slap on a smile and do it all again. That's not it's funny. I love Bill. But that's not a way that you should feel when you're about to do your comedy show. You should feel like, oh boy, here it comes. You know, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to tell these people what I want to tell them, and we're all going to have a great time. That's how you want to feel. And so I feel like I'm at a good place for that right now, and I'm enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was Jake Johansson. Such a pleasure to speak to Jake. Do check him out, jakethis.com, at jakethis on Twitter and presumably other social media forms as well. And his podcast is called Jake This. So look out for that. What else was I going to tell you? The Insiders Club stuff. Yes, Jake on how to survive a corporate, how to thrive in a corporate comedy gig, and also that big decision about Seinfeld, all available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And go to comedianscomedian.com/tour for all the tour information. We'll get post-ambling. That's all for now. I'm going to talk to you about resilience, and I'm going to talk to you about my little Leicester experiment after this noise. But for now, that concludes the podcast. Okay, so post-ambling, and I will admit now that I'm talking to the inner circle of post-ambulists, I'm actually parked next to a recycling bin in the shade. It's the second day of spring. God, spring's here at last, thank Christ. I'm parked, and I might get booted out at some point. I'm sort of on someone else's... I'm in an industrial estate. Yeah, it's pretty industrial. So... here are the things that happened. Thank you so much to those of you who got in touch about my resilience presentation. Oh God, I'm going to have to whip that bit off the end of the Jeff Innocent episode. Brackets, how good was Jeff, right? Right? Because they are no longer available. The freebies got snapped up, and I will get beavering away on that and get it all tuned up and then probably tell you about it again in a new form once it exists. But thank you to everyone that's been in touch. Sorry, I can't come and do all of them. And then Leicester... what a stressful day that was. I had to remind myself of the new show. The tour show, end of. I had to kind of get it back in the bone. Like, I really enjoyed doing it in Maidenhead on the Friday night. And then I knew in the morning, on the Saturday at the Leicester Comedy Festival, I was like, I have to write a new hour from scratch right now. And even when that's done, then I've got to do a bit more pacing around, listening to my headphones and trying to get the show end of back in my bones, because it's so, when you're in Edinburgh and you're just banging it out every day, you have so much fluidity and so much fluency with it. And the show in Maidenhead, I was like, here's the show, and it was the show. And then afterwards I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if I was just a little bit more flexible throughout it. So I had that hanging over me when I drove to Leicester at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, knowing that at 3:45 p.m. I was going to present... the title of the show was, this show doesn't have a title, it's not even the word untitled, it just literally has no title. And the blurb was something like, I think, what did I write? In my continuing quest to pare back creative efficiency to the very marrow, I hereby guarantee that I will not have done any work on this show until the morning of the performance. Sure, yeah, big words, Goldsmith. Here's what I was trying to achieve. It is about creative efficiency, and it's also... But what does that mean? What it really means is I live every year of my life with the monkey of I've got to write a new show on my back. So this was an experiment designed to discover whether I could not write anything for months so I could get on with other stuff, pod-related stuff, life-related stuff, having a baby-related stuff, without writing. And this flies in the face of so many people's advice. Gary Gulman, you know, write every day. Jerry Seinfeld into that, write every day, every day, every day. I just felt creatively burnt out. I needed some time off. And I should say, these Americans who say write every day, they're not turning over a fresh hour that's festival ready every year. Not all of them, some of them. So I felt burnt out and I was like, right, I need a break. I need to just let my brain unclench and see what comes in. And I think it worked. There's some good stuff in there. I mean, so I turned up, I did the show, people came, there were 40 odd people there. Thank you to everyone that came to that. And then I had to just wing it. I had scribbled for like 4 1/4 hours, just like this idea, this idea, this idea, this idea. Let's then write them out. Let's then trim them down and just put them until they're just 2 words on a bunch of index cards, 2 words per card. Any more than that, I end up flying with my face buried in the dashboard. So, you know, in the cockpit, you are in the cockpit. The dashboard of the cockpit, is it still called a dashboard? My point is, you can't be reading jokes out. You have to look at the card, right, that's the thing. Now try and convince them of it. And it was a really exciting experience. I think halfway through it, I thought to myself, even if this goes brilliantly well, I'm never doing it again, because that morning was very supercharged and tense. And stressful, but
some good gear came out of it. And it has made me feel like I could do that again. I could just kind of, rather than writing, I could simply be open to the universe, and then do all the writing. And it certainly made me feel that were I doing a fresh hour at Edinburgh this year, I'd be panicking from now, but it wouldn't be impossible. I could start in February and write from then. But I'm not doing a new hour in Edinburgh this year. But I think I am doing a work in progress every day at a venue that is pretty much decided but not publicly released yet. So I'll keep that to myself. You'll be the first to know, I assure you. So I think I'm going to go up there and try and do something similar every day. It was so exhilarating. If I can go to Edinburgh and every afternoon do an hour that I spent 2 hours that morning writing towards and then blatting it out there. Or even, I haven't quite decided, hey, other comics who've done this, or people who've done this in different walks of life, or people who haven't, just give me an opinion. What do you think would be more fertile? Should I be trying to write every day and try new stuff every day? Or should I be trying to walk on with nothing every day, Tommy Tiernan style, and just taking what Alfie Brown recently referred to as a big creative dump every day and clawing my way out of it? What is the better way to activate creativity, given that I have the opportunity now for this experiment, what is going to come up with the most honest stuff? Writing and then trying it, or having no writing and trying to just speak truth? Truth, I don't mean truth, I don't mean big geopolitical truth, but like, just the whole point of it is not to fuck about. The point of it is to be as honest as possible. And I think in the moment, it reminds me of a clown exercise I did years ago with my brilliant clown Marcello Magni teaching. And it was about trying to find your first instinct, and your first instinct being the most honest instinct. And there are moments I feel engaged with that on stage. So I suppose ultimately, is it a writing exercise? Is it a sort of performing, clowning kind of authenticity exercise? And I suppose it's the second one. But, yeah, we'll have to see. I think it's going to be really good fun. I think it's going to be really frightening fun. that'll probably do for now. There's other things happening in my life. The baby still has reflux. Bless the baby. She's Future Girl is so sweet and good-natured. And, oh, my God, when the Boutros walks into the room, her eyes light up. She loves him. You can just say his name to her. Like, do you know who's going to be up in a minute? The Boutros, brackets real name redacted, and her little face, it just shines. It's so beautiful, and he's so sweet, and he's so excited about the idea of, like, do you think that one day I will read a book, and she will listen to the book, and she will read a book as well? And you're like, yeah, I think she will, mate. So that's glorious. That's really lovely. And I am going to go back to them now. There is some allotted parenting time after the admin blast I've been doing, which concluded with this industrial estate-based recording sesh. I feel like the acoustics. I'm in my van, and it's a very 80s van. It's a Mazda Bongo. It used to belong to Rob Rouse, and as a result, it's called Shaniqua in tribute to the duck that he once owned. If you ever saw him do the material on Shaniqua, mwah, first class. I think the acoustics are quite good because it's quite an 80s van, so there's a lot of carpet up the walls. Okay, that'll do for now. Thanks once again to Jake. Thanks for listening. I don't bang on so often about reviewing the show, but we are over 1,000 five-star reviews on iTunes now, which is sexy and cool and probably helps in some way. So particularly if you listen to the show via iTunes in another country. I think iTunes is the country-specific one. Most other podcatcher ratings seem to be globalized. But if you're listening via iTunes in a country other than the UK, please leave me a review, an honest review. But sure, if you don't like the show, don't feel under pressure to leave a review. But if you fancy leaving us a lovely five-star review, then please do so. And that will really help me become more visible in wherever you are listening. So that's it for now. Look forward to this Thursday, the 28th. We're releasing the tour, the second half of the tour, and releasing Like I Mean It on super top-notch video on cheapo mode, where you watch the 55-minute spanking clean version, and hardcore awesome fan mode, where you pay £5 and get the whole lot. So there we go. That's that. I'll speak to you soon. Bye for now.
Hold up.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.